The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly for the week beginning the 2nd of September. It's your 30-minute break from the stresses and strains of everyday life. Today we're here to soothe you with talk of action heroes and high-tech gadgetry. It's like the soft sound of porpoises mooing in the moonlight. Anyway, I'm Alex Krotowski, and I've clearly been stuck at my desk writing my PhD for too long. Joining me to get lost in the whimsy is Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both. Now, Charles, you've just returned from holiday. What have you been playing with?
We had 2 weeks where we had absolutely no television, no internet. I took one phone call, and we spent it on the beach. And it was fantastic. Oh, I recommend it.
How did you have none of that? Because
By going to a place that doesn't have any of those.
Oh, I see. So removing yourself from the situation.
Absolutely.
Nicely done.
And Jemima, what have you been playing with?
I've been playing with Inquisitor, which is a plugin for Safari that gives you different options on different search tools, which is quite natty. I still like Safari. I know it's wrong and I should be using other things, but it's just clean and simple and you can have multiple tabs and I like it. Sorry.
Have you seen the new Firefox 3?
There's just too much stuff in Firefox. It
looks exactly like Safari. It looks exactly like Safari.
Okay, I'll have a look.
Well, I don't like it, actually, for that reason. But anyway, moving on. On today's show, we're meeting Adrian Hahn, one half of the superstar London-based brother duo who are taking over the James Bond franchise and making it more high-tech than Q could ever have imagined. We're also delving deeper into Vista, taking a leaf out of last week, dissecting the security system therein. All this, plus the latest news from the world of technology and the latest views from you. Stick with us, we're miles better than a motivational poster. Adrian and Dan Hahn have taken a bite off a very large cherry with their latest interactive project. The brothers behind the alternate reality games company Six to Start are hell-bent on taking over as many media properties as possible, and they're doing a very good job of it. They've taken contracts from the BBC, Channel 4, Penguin Publishing, and now the people behind James Bond. I believe they've even done something, a little something for The Guardian.
I don't know whether we did anything specifically, but we were involved in the game camp. Obviously.
That's true, actually, yes. That is true. And I think that's what we were talking about. Anyway, combining a unique and fresh and inherently interactive look at how people consume stories, television and other media, Six to Start, is now taking on the task with Charlie Higson's newest young Bond novel. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Now, we have featured you before as an elevator pitch, but just to give a bit of background, can you tell us what it is that you do?
We both run a company called Six to Start, and we both came from previously a company called Mind Candy, which made an alternate reality game called Perplex City. And this was an online treasure hunt that involved hundreds of thousands of people around the world looking for a treasure worth £100,000 buried somewhere in the UK. So after Perplex City finished, we set up a new company to make alternate reality games, these sort of mashup of online and offline real-world gaming and online gaming for, well, companies like the BBC and Channel 4 and brands.
And the Young Bond franchises, it was launched last week, wasn't it?
That's right, yes. So we just launched a game to promote the final book of the Young Bond series. So the last book is called By Royal Command, which is probably the coolest sounding title out of the five. And, you know, they were looking for a way to promote the book in a way that really kind of conveyed what the books were all about. I think, you know, they've done previous games, platformers and things like that. But the difference of our game is that it really feels something like a cross between a point-and-click adventure and a book. So you do some reading in it. You really get into the world and you get to know as if you're talking to the characters and you can feel like you're a spy instead of just, you know, jumping around and blowing stuff up.
I haven't actually read any of the Young Bond, the Charlie Higson books. I mean, I read all the original James Bond books many years ago. One would sort of logically think the Young Bond books would be set before the old James Bond books, which would put them back in the sort of 40s or something. I mean, where actually are they set? And how do you fit your thing into a world where, you know, the readers are going to have mobile phones and the internet and the instant messaging and so on?
The books are absolutely kind of loyal to the Bond universe. So they're set in the 1930s. When James Bond is at Eton, he's still schoolboy there at least for a couple of years. And yeah, of course, there's no technology really, and there's no gadgets actually in the books, which is a nice change. It's been a real challenge for us because almost all alternate reality games are set either in the present or in the future. So you can involve mobile phones, you can involve email and all these different sorts of things, and it makes sense that you have websites and Google and so on in the game. And in a way, you know, that's kind of nice for modern games, but also it's a bit of a crutch because you always end up doing the same sort of boring stuff like looking at source code and using Google and so on. So that's why we kind of made it into more of a point-and-click adventure that also uses the web. So when you go to a place, the website you go to feels like a cross between sort of a town's website, a village website, but also as if you're looking at a notice board. So when you go to the post office, you can look through all the different letters, and when you have to go and create a fake ID, you're doing that. Also, in a mission that's coming next week, you have to go and look at a map of the Royal Docks and find one ship that's hiding there. And so we use the Google Maps technology there. So it's not just, obviously, something that you could do in Flash or something that you could do offline. We are using the internet, but we're doing it in a way that doesn't seem completely at odds with the time it's supposed to be, 1934, I think.
And how much freedom are you given to create the characters and the plots within that? Because James Bond's a very well-established brand. I can imagine they need to have some control over that.
I was really surprised by how flexible those guys have been, actually, because we're used to writing stuff and getting reams of notes back from, you know, the producers. I remember we sent off a few thousand words of copy and we got two lines highlighted, and that was it. So I thought there was a mistake. I mean, it helps that the plot was written by Charlie Higson. So he's been quite involved in coming up with the story.
You mean the plot for the game?
The plot for the game was written by him. So in a way, it really is kind of a sick story.
It's actually quite interesting that you bring that up, because one of your previous projects was We Tell Stories with Penguin Publishing. And again, you involved the authors with the technology. And so it must have been quite a lot of fun for Higson and these other authors to play around with this interactive space.
It's always the first meeting that's quite difficult with authors because, you know, it feels like, oh, we're having to do some extra work. We have to write some extra story for some weird internet thing. But, you know, if we can sort of get over that barrier and realize, hey, you can do something really interesting with this medium, you can tell stories in interesting ways, I think they get really excited and they start actually writing a lot of stuff. I think Charlie at first, you know, he had a lot of work to do with publicizing the book and flying around the world and stuff. But when he got into it, he produced a really great story for us.
What types of things are you integrating into the story that are more appropriate for kids than, say, for Perplex City or for any of the other projects that you've worked with?
One of the big things is that we have to make the game a lot easier and a lot shorter as well, actually. That's not to say that, you know, kids don't know how to sort of use the internet or solve puzzles. They're very good at doing that. But just making sure there's always a lot of feedback going on so that if they get something wrong, there's an error message. If they, you know, there's hinting going on, so the path is really clear. Because the problem with alternate reality games is technically you can kind of do anything. You can go off and do a web search. You can go and try and email the characters or call them up. We want to make sure that it's quite clear what you need to do.
Isn't there also the thing, I mean, you're talking about it being aimed at children aged 9 to 14?
Yeah.
And there's quite a big developmental difference between a 9-year-old and a 14-year-old, isn't there?
We try and pitch our games to as wide an audience as possible, and it means that some people who play the games find them too easy. We're not about making games difficult. We're about making games fun. And so we will always err on making games a bit easier. And so a kid who's 9 who reads Young Bond will have no problems playing this. I think if you're 14, then you'll have more fun spotting all the different in-jokes and little clues that we've hidden all across it.
Does it make a difference that they're digital natives as well, that they're that much more technically literate and used to using the internet?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they, you know, there's a lot less that we need to explain, and we actually have to make sure that the game is kind of protected, because I think these guys are very good at attacking games, actually. And, you know, we have to make sure that they can't mess things up.
One last question. Alternate reality games, they've become quite a buzzword. And I remember thinking last year that this is going to be the thing that's bigger than Twitter. But I see, not just with you guys, but with the other alternate reality game companies that are out there, that they are very much falling into the marketing frame. Mm. And how do you ensure that alternate reality games as an art form or whatever it is, as a development process, as a plaything, doesn't just go down that one route and goes in sort towards something like the Perplex City model, which is self-funded?
You know, trying to get people to pay for anything is difficult. And, you know, people are finding this tricky because traditionally gamers have seen alternate reality games as just things that should be free. I think Perplex City was obviously, you know, a really good exploration of how an ARG could be self-funding. Another project that I'm working on outside of Sixer Start is making a charity alternate reality game that will raise money for Cancer Research UK. So that's not marketing. We're talking to the BBC and we're talking to Channel 4 and other brands and broadcasters about making original games that are sort of equivalent to making a TV series. And that's really quite exciting for us. But I think it requires a big cultural change within bigger organizations. And then we're working on that.
Well, thank you very much, Adrian, for coming in. And I look forward to my package of Secret Service paraphernalia landing in my inbox soon. And Young Bond is it the game is at youngbond.com?
Yeah, you can get it from youngbond.com or directly from youngbondshadowwar.com.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. Now here's Jemima with the news.
Google hurriedly launched a new open-source web browser called Chrome after an employee leaked a comic book explanation to a tech blog. Chrome is designed to cope with heavy interactive applications, as well as improved security and stability, but more on that in next week's show. Nokia launched an attack on the iPhone's dominance of mobile music by introducing its Comes With Music range. Prepay customers will be able to choose from 2.1 million downloads for no extra charge, and all in time for the Christmas market. Microsoft said hello to Chow, the European price comparison site, as it bought the company for $266 million. Chow will be integrated into its MSN consumer portal. And Bloomberg accidentally published an obituary of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, but retracted it 30 seconds later. An ad for the 3G iPhone was killed off, however, after regulators said the phone didn't live up to its claims to offer all the internet.
So, Jemima, tell me what the story is here with Chow.
This is all part of Microsoft fighting back after things not quite working out with Yahoo and obviously competing with Google. They want to invest $1.2 billion every year in web services to try and compete with Google. So this is one of Europe's biggest price comparison websites, and they've spent £266 million buying it. That's a big chunk of investment in an area which is very popular. They're going to incorporate it into MSN.
That's an enormous amount of money.
It's an enormous amount of money, yeah. But somebody the other day described e-commerce as the GDP of online, and that will be what drives the online industry through recession, because the trend for consumers going online is stronger than the downturn overall. That's the belief, anyway.
Well, it's good news then for credit.
We'll have to wait and see whether Google's right or Alistair Darling.
If they're intending to buy, they're intending to spend that much money every year, what do you think is going to come into their portfolio over the next couple of years?
Lordy, I don't know if I knew that. I should be in investment somewhere and not journalism. But it's an extremely canny buy. It sits very well into MSN, and you can imagine how they'd incorporate that next to all the different specialist subject areas on the site.
The interesting comparison, I think, is with Google, because Google did try to do Frugal.
That's right.
Which,
still there.
Which
still
is
there.
Sort of still there, but is sort of dropping off the Google toolbar.
As you say, Chow is one of the top European price comparison sites out there. But does this mean that the smaller companies, the baby startups, aren't going to fall into that pool of however much you said that they're going to be spending every year?
We're likely to see different sites, e-commerce sites, springing up around different areas. So you might see one that's specifically price comparison for mobile at a completely random guess. That's what I think will happen to the market. It's going to become more specialised. And maybe it's not enough for Microsoft to just have Chow because it's too generalist.
Just moving swiftly to the right and talk a little bit about the iPhone.
Steve Jobs returns from the dead.
Well,
way,
you know,
at least he's done better than Princess Diana.
I hesitate to berate any colleagues in journalism because it can happen to the best of us. And Bloomberg only put this out for 30 seconds before they realised, which is fairly on the ball. They just put it on an external wire instead of an internal one. But even so, it's pretty bad. And the reason it is bad, obviously, is because Steve Jobs has been ill and has suffered from cancer, and there have been rumours that this reoccurred.
Oh, golly.
Yes, oh, golly indeed.
None of them true. Well, apart from them, did have cancer.
It was a bit more than a stomach bug, I think he said at the time. Anyway, what did get killed off, rather, was the TV ad for Apple's iPhone, which said something along the lines of, "You never know which part of the internet you'll need, which is why all parts of the internet are available on an iPhone." Apart from Flash and Java, of course.
How does the iPhone do for blogging? Because I tested a T-Mobile phone.
You mean for blogging? For actually
for
blogging
actually
or for reading
blogging? Blog? No, for actual blogging. Because
I haven't blogged from my iPhone.
Yeah,
you can get the WordPress program, which will run on your iPhone.
Because that was something that I found was a real limitation from any mobile blogging. Or not even blogging, but any mobile web access. Because I use multiple tabs. I do certain things. I need to input user-generated content everywhere I go.
Anything where you have to input a large amount of text is not that convenient. Anything where you're browsing it is pretty good, like photos and well, photos. But entering big chunks of text is not that easy, so I wouldn't really want to do it. I'd wait till I get home.
Or carry one of those, you know, Asus-style Lilliputers or ultra-portables.
Nano-pooters.
Yeah, the, yes. Yeah, knee tops. <They're Well, awesome.
laughs> You can read about these stories and many
ankle
more.
Tops.
And ankle tops at guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week, we learned about Windows 7, the next generation operating system that Microsoft is hoping will smooth over the issues, security, usability and otherwise, with Vista. This summer, Windows XP was officially declared dead. So we're continuing the theme. We're flogging a horse, as it were, and we're looking at Vista security. Charles, what can you tell us about it?
Before Vista was released, there were lots of promises about how Microsoft would bulk up its security, which was lacking in the very first versions of XP. I remember meeting the managing director of Microsoft UK when XP was first released and said, "Why didn't you turn the firewall on, you know, by default?" And he said, "Yes, we did." And I said, "No, you didn't." And it turned into something of an argument between us. But things did improve with XP Service Pack 2. XP became a much more secure operating system. But to see whether all the promises had been lived up to, I asked the opinion of BT's Chief Security Technology Officer, Bruce Schneier, who's also one of our columnists. You'll hear from him in a moment. But I started by speaking to Mike Irwin of Webroot, and I asked him what, if any, new threats have appeared since the launch of Vista.
We're seeing, you know, much more financially motivated security threats. The amount of unique malware in the wild has grown 500% over the course of the past year. And that's a trend that does not appear to be slowing down anytime soon.
When you say malware, is this viruses contained in emails or is this phishing?
It's a combination of all of the above. 10 years ago, most malware attacks occurred via email. And in today's world, most malware attacks occur over the web.
Why do you think that is?
I think to a certain degree, email protocol has been somewhat secured, whether it's at the ISP level or at the corporate level. There's really not a company out there that I know of that's not running antivirus at their mail gateway today. On the web side, however, it's much more challenging from a technology perspective to be able to provide that type of scanning on the HTTP protocol. And, you know, the other side, if you will, is taking full advantage.
Now, when Microsoft launched Vista more than a year ago, one of the big themes about it was that it would be much more secure than XP. Are you seeing that? Is it actually turning out to be that way? Because there's a lot of talk around of people wanting to stick with XP because they don't like Vista for one reason or another.
Microsoft made a lot of strides in securing the operating system. That being said, it's a big operating system, and I think there are always new areas of vulnerability that are discovered in any system. And I think very quickly after the launch of Vista, we saw malware that was written specifically for Vista, and were able to develop code that in many cases was able to circumvent, you know, one of the big features that was promoted, which was the user access control, and ultimately launch on the operating system.
Is there a difference between consumers who are using Vista and enterprises using Vista? Are the enterprises more locked down about forcing UAC on people?
We're not necessarily seeing large enterprise-wide deployments of Vista currently. We are seeing, you know, uptake in the consumer markets, particularly in the area of new PCs. So not necessarily folks upgrading from XP to Vista, but as people refresh their PCs, they ultimately get their next PC with Vista installed.
So Vista may be more secure than XP, but as Mike said, people aren't rushing to install it on their existing machines. Bruce Schneier thinks that's a missed opportunity, as a new installation is when security is at its strongest.
For home users, they rarely actually do anything to improve security. So the security is best when they just bought it, and it will decay slowly over time as they maybe don't install patches or malware infects them or they get third-party applications. And they'll do things that'll slowly degrade security. There's a lot of security features in Vista that aren't in XP, and they're turned on by default, making your typical home Vista user more secure than your typical home XP user. For the enterprise, it depends a lot on how well the security is maintained by the IT department. You know, the problem for home users is they don't have an IT department. So home users are in general at a great disadvantage because they're just sort of left alone. But out of the box, sure, they're as secure as they could be.
Do you think that people don't patch their systems because they don't know they need patching or because they don't know how to do it?
Microsoft did really well when they went to once-a-month patching. Most Windows computers, especially for home users, have automatic update turned on. So once a month, they'll get the critical Windows patches. They will not get the patches for their application software. And whether they don't know that they should look for them or they don't know how to install them when they get them or they just don't know what to do, they're not getting installed. So the quality of the software, whether it's, you know, Microsoft Office or some third-party application, will decay as vulnerabilities are found and are not patched. And that's something that an enterprise will get better. I mean, they'll have someone whose job it is to make sure that patches are up to date.
It still sounds a long way from the sort of Steve Jobs idea of the computer as being as an appliance, as sort of like a toaster or a dishwasher.
We've convinced everybody that they need a computer. Right? My mother has one. And at the same time, we've made them so hard to use that it takes an expert to configure and maintain one. And you know, that is a problem. For a lot of people, when their computer goes bad, all they can do is buy a new one. It's a large, opaque, complex box. You know, I was talking to someone at Microsoft who said the typical user uses all the standard things that you'd expect plus one unique thing. Maybe it's a piece of genealogy software. Maybe it's some game no one's ever heard of. So we can't make it standard because everybody has something different they do. And that makes it hard. Microsoft is trying very hard to make its systems secure automatically for home users. But there's always going to be something weird.
So what are the different types of threats that enterprise and home users face? Or is there any difference at all? Mike Irwin of Webroot.
Because the internet doesn't differentiate between users, you know, oftentimes the threats are exactly the same. You know, consumers in particular get targeted in mass, typically using some form of social engineering to hook them into a behavior and ultimately either provide access or ultimately even provide information to a third party who is able to then turn around and monetize that. And that can be in the form of a phishing attack, in the form of a Trojan, in the form of, you know, keystroke loggers, et cetera, system monitors that are ultimately built and designed to harvest information.
When HMRC announced last year that it had lost the disks with the details of the child benefit database, everyone was appalled that they weren't encrypted already. And similarly with the laptops that have been found on eBay recently coming from banks and from borough councils. So how can we protect our machines? Microsoft made a great deal of introducing drive encryption into Vista. So is it worth it? Is it the great solution to our security problem?
For the average home user, their home computer is as secure as their door lock. And that's probably okay, because their important papers are in the house with the computer. Taking a computer on the road is a bit different. I mean, you're going to have important stuff on it. You're going to have passwords. You're going to have financial data. You're going to have things that a thief is going to want. Luckily, encrypting a hard drive is easy. It's free, and you won't even notice any slowdown. You know, some versions of Vista come with something called BitLocker, which is Microsoft's internal hard drive encryption program, and that'll be rolled out soon to everybody. These are easy to turn on and easy to use, and what they really do is means you don't have to worry about it. Right? If I lose my computer, and I travel all over the world, it's just an expense. You know, and that's the lesson from the, you know, losing that child database. If they encrypted those disks, it would not have been a story.
That was Bruce Schneier from BT. So Charles, the idea here is that the security for Vista is better, but people are going to circumvent it. They're going to go around it because it's in your face.
It's more annoying.
That's it.
Yeah.
So what is it about it that makes it better? What are the features that make it better?
Compared to XP, it's had a lot stripped out. XP carried on from where MS-DOS had left off and had a lot of the inherent insecurities, certainly in Windows XP, the original, that you would have in any single user computer system that hadn't actually heard of the internet. Vista is simply rethought from the ground up. They basically lost an entire year when Bill Gates sent out a memo saying, you guys, actually, the internet's not always entirely safe, I've discovered.
Can somebody please explain to me in small words why it is that macOS seems to have better security features, is more impenetrable?
It's a minority market, so people didn't, if they want to attack people, they go for the most people they can attack at once.
They do. The Mac system really hasn't come under the sort of well-paid, financially motivated hacker attack on anything like the scale that Windows has. Windows has this long heritage it was the prevalent system and it was the one that was around when the internet got big and the hackers realized that there was money to be made from people. But if criminal gangs really did decide to start going at the Mac system, if it got enough traction, if there was somehow enough people online using it, you know, really, you'd have to be talking about the sort of 10, 20% almost for it to be there, then you'd see a lot of people with Macs finding that they'd been hacked. Because the flaws do exist, and they tend not to be fixed as fast, actually, as in Windows.
Extending this, actually, this idea of the open source systems, you know, I hear more and more about people using Linux and this and that and the other. Surely these are even more open to potential attacks than some of the Windows and the Mac OS systems? Because they are so open, the code is out there, anybody can go in and
If anybody can find the holes in them, then yeah, and there have been attacks against open systems. WordPress, which is an open source blog system, there was actually a case about a year or so ago where a hacker uploaded a hacked version of WordPress that, if people installed it, would basically give them a backdoor into it, and a lot of blogs were compromised via that. So the open source model isn't perfect, but it tends to get fixed quite quickly once the community realizes what's going on.
Do you have faith in what the Vista security system has in store for us or for those people who are currently using Vista?
Faith is one of those funny words, isn't it?
I don't go with
faith generally. Is there evidence that the Vista security model is better? Yeah, there is. You know, it is absolutely better than the XP security system.
I mean, it's consumer confidence is the term, isn't it?
But consumer confidence is one of those things that can go this way and that, depending on which way the wind's blowing.
Well, you can find out more about this at guardian.co.uk/technology, of course. And I promise we won't talk about Microsoft next week unless they do something crazy like buy Yahoo or something.
Never happen.
It will never happen.
Well, enough from us now. Let's hear from you. What's been happening in the blogs, Jemima?
It's that Steve Jobs again and him dying, or not dying, not definitely not dying. So we obviously had to write about it on PDA, and just a few amusing responses from people. Boy Blue said they thought he was dead, but someone from support suggested they turn him off and back on again.
that's funny.
And just a few more serious comments by people saying, I don't know why people are so surprised that news organisations write obituaries in advance. Randomizer said, I'm surprised that people find this surprising. Steve Jobs isn't the first famous person to have their obit published ahead of their death. Wasn't it Mark Twain who said reports of his death have been greatly exaggerated after his obit was published?
Well, over on the games blog, Greg's been talking about sports games, and I have to admit that I'm not very au fait with sports games at all, simply because I'm terrible at them and I only like to play things that I'm good at. But Ivor B similarly says, sports games suck unless they make a soccer game, and he says soccer, unless they make a soccer game where you can play as one of the spectators and shoot the players from the stands, I'm not interested. Headshot the goalie in mid-save for massive damage, hee hee hee. Mercenaries 2 looks pants also, nothing for me there, grumble grumble. So he's just generally an all-around miserable guy. But my favorite bit was Bert Janish says, ah, come on Ivor, it's been a long time since you were the last person to be picked in games. Get over it. Handbags at dawn. Have you had any of these playground antics over on the technology blog this week?
Not very much, I've got to say. There was some fun to be had with the Amazon Kindle. And would there be a Kindle 2.0 this year? And would it be over here in the UK? And Business Week said that there was a new Kindle coming. And then Amazon itself said no. To which Slapman had the what I think is the wonderful description for why. He said, no new Kindle this year. We're waiting on a fresh delivery of ugly paint.
Could I just very quickly add, I was trying a Sony ebook reader at the weekend, just a 2-day trial, and I was really quite impressed.
Uh-oh.
I was expecting to be a bit sceptical, but actually the screen resolution is really impressive.
Here we go, ebooks, it's the
whatever,
future, e-publishing.
Whatever angle, little bit slow to 10 pages, a couple of other things.
What sort of file formats will it accept?
Well, I think they're all proprietary formats at this stage.
So surprised that Sony would only take proprietary formats.
Never, not Sony.
That's so unlikely.
It came in a really nice leather-bound thing, and it was light and small, and I was really quite impressed.
But also, you can get in on the chat at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/digital-content/games, or you can go retro and send us an email at tech@guardian.co.uk. Don't forget, we have a Flickr group, which is Guardian Tech Weekly, where we upload pictures each week And this week there were a couple of messages. One was left by John Sevenoaks, who said, "Great picture. My wife has a pair of wellies very similar to Jemima's."
I just love the I've very similar to.
Steady.
I mean, they're wellies.
Wowzer was quite prolific. He said of my picture of Jack, "No pipe, very disappointing." I like to think that that's how Wowzer talks. And he also mentioned the very arty picture I thought I took of the studio wall with the. I don't know if you can hear that, but that's the egg boxes and the soundproofing. Yeah. And he says that we need to do a remake, a reshot of Station to Station, David Bowie. So we might do that this week. You can see our pictures of our lovely guests on our Flickr group. And you can get our tweets and call our Skype voicemail. I mean, there's so many ways you can get in touch with us. It boggles the mind. Find out how on our website. Click on podcast at guardian.co.uk/technology and find all the links there.
In the Guardian's tech section this Thursday, we look at how a number of wind turbines have broken apart, flinging blades hundreds of feet, and in other cases, the towers themselves have collapsed. As we rush to build more turbines, we ask if we're spinning to destruction. How safe are they really? Who sets safety standards? And how do we know that they're following them? We look at Google's announcement of a new browser and funds for people to build applications for its new mobile phone, and we test the latest iPhone headphones. We say happy birthday to Bluetooth, which is 10 years old. And we ask the thorny question, if you have sex in Second Life with someone who's not your real-life partner, is it cheating? That's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
There's quite a bit coming up over the next couple of weeks. Jemima, what's in your diary?
This evening, actually, I'll be going to the Chinwag event, which is all about search versus recommendation, which is a very interesting thing to explore. And there's quite a few good startup companies that are going to be there. So I will be writing about that on PDA.
Excelente. Charles?
I'm going to be looking more into crime mapping because it's around about now that we're expecting to see crime maps coming out in greater availability and finding out about local councils charging for data.
And I'm going to be looking at or hearing about the social web at Deconstruct in Brighton, beautiful Brighton. And I'm going to be at the Sirius Virtual Worlds Conference in Coventry at the end of next week. So it's all go.
How do you define a
serious? The humorous ones?
It's all about being serious. No, it's about using
the comedy
serious
virtual
ends.
Worlds.
It's one-liners only. You're out of here. No, it's about simulation and collaboration and how people are using spaces like that for those types of things.
Social entrepreneurship. And the like.
Indeed. Indeed. So if you've got something to say or an event that you'd like to let us know about, please do head to guardian.co.uk/audio to find us. We'll be there for you, man. Many thanks to our esteemed guests, Adrian, Mike and Bruce. Thanks as well to our lovely podistas, Jemima and Charles, and the man behind the curtain, Scott. Give us a wave, Scott. Wait. Oh, there he is. Let me out of here, he says.
Let him out of his box.
I'm Alex Kotowski, and we will be back next Tuesday, so we shall see you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.